Greetings. This is Joe McKesson, Marketing Director for the New Orleans Opera, and I am starting a new podcast here this season to celebrate our 75th anniversary. Now, I'm new to New Orleans, and I'm kind of taking advantage of that fact to learn about New Orleans through the arts. So I'm taking each opera one step at a time, each group one step at a time, so you and I can learn more about them. There's a rich heritage here of opera going back 222 years. Yes, 222 years. This is America's first city of opera, and the first opera was performed here in 1796, Jean Tri's Sylvain. That's why we have a Sylvain Society, in case you were wondering. So today I'm going to think about all the great things that we're doing for our anniversary. We're expanding the season. We are trying to create audience inclusion, which means we present works that appeal to everybody who lives in New Orleans. And also we're extending the outreach of our education program into new schools and new programs that we've never had before. Basically, we want to celebrate opera every day, every week, every month, and every year, starting with this year, our 75th anniversary. Opera Connects. So as part of that, I wanted to create this podcast called New Orleans Opera at Large. I am going to be taking our wonderful singers that come to sing with us, our wonderful members, board members, societies, and bring them to the fore in podcast so that you can learn about them and hear music that relates to their lives. Because, of course, opera and music is the core of why we have this great passion for the arts here in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans is an art city non-parallel to any that I've ever been in, and I've lived in many, many cities, and that includes New York. There is a diversity of art here, and writers, and painters that blow my mind. So I'm going to start with, of course, our very own opera this year. So it's our 75th anniversary, and we're blowing it out. We have seven operas this year. Seven operas, and more venues. So more choices than you've ever had before for opera here in New Orleans. And I hope that you're taking advantage of it, because we've already got two down. Maria de Buenos Aires was a huge success. We sold out, and audiences that had never seen opera became enmeshed and passionate about it through the music of tango, the music of Piazzolla. And then we, of course, had our wonderful opening night of Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci, which was a huge success, bringing the tradition of opera to the fore of our season. Our actual 75th anniversary opera began in 1943 with Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci, and that's why we chose that for our premiere. Unfortunately, though, we had another thing in New Orleans that I have to learn about, and that's a hurricane. Or a tropical storm, or a depression, depending on how you look at it. For us, it was a bit of a depression because we didn't get to do our Sunday performance, which, of course, made many of us very sad because we wanted to do more than one. So it became a non-opera within a non-hurricane, which was not a very good thing. So if you're so inclined, please go and donate at neworleansopera.org right now. Now, of course, our next main stage show is the most exciting of all because it is a part of our dedication to French repertoire, which is something I'm learning a lot about here in New Orleans in terms of our relationship to Paris, our sister city, the City of Lights. And so to that end, we are dedicating our next opera to everything that is Parisian. In Louisiana, and that is Jacques Offenbach's Orpheus in the Underworld. This is a startlingly weird and fun and periodic opera because it is a satire on the Second Empire, which has a lot of parallels to today if you really think about it. So if we want to think about satire and where that went, in 1858, Jacques Offenbach was a starving musician in Paris trying to make his way as a composer. And of course, then composers were the most revered and loved of artists, thanks to Rossini and those who had come before him to Paris. And he made his way with this little piece of political satire that then inspired the rest of Europe to start making parodies in operetta form. In particular, our most famous duo that we all know, Gilbert and Sullivan. So Offenbach's wonderful parody of Orpheus in the Underworld is a romp of the gods who kind of choose a musician, an everyday Joe, as it were, or in this case, an everyday Orpheus, to go on a tour of hell to get back his wife. Or does he want her back? These things we'll never know until we go to the opera or unless we leak it or spoiler it here. My guest today is a native son, and this one artist has been a New Orleans audience favorite for quite a while because he's performed a lot of opera here in New Orleans, and so he has lots of fans. And his name is Casey Candabot, who is here today to discuss Orpheus, his life, and everything that opera has done to it or for it.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, I'm so excited that you're doing Orpheus in the Underworld. Obviously, it's one of those operas that not a lot of people know. It's its premiere here. We've never done it in New Orleans before.
That's right.
So what can you tell us about it that might be interesting?
Well, everyone, I think, knows the Can-Can, the most famous number at the end of the Act Two finale. Orpheus was done actually once in New Orleans before, but not by New Orleans Opera. It was done by Loyola University in probably 2007. I was actually in that production.
Oh, wow.
And that was its kind of city premiere. But this is the first time the real company is taking it on, and they're doing much better things than we did with it in college. Orpheus is a wonderful piece because it is hilariously funny. I mean, you mentioned the satire that Offenbach put in it, and it's so appropriate for New Orleans because the satire is exactly the same as a carnival parade. I mean, you feel like you're watching the crew of chaos go down the avenue because every float has more and more satire on it. That's what this piece was. It was meant to just be a raucous commentary on everything going on in that period. And what our director, Alison Moritz, and what Maestro Robert Lyle have done is they have brought the dialogue more contemporary. They've made the jokes and the satire a little more relevant to today's society without getting into the political world so that we don't ruffle anyone's feathers.
Right, right. Yeah, politics is very dicey.
It is.
You don't want to go one way or the other. But this operetta seems to go every direction since you start in heaven and end in hell and everything in between, right?
That's right. It's very important to know before you come into this opera, or operetta rather, you need to have a basic knowledge of mythology. You know, in the actual Orpheus myth, he's this great lyre player. He plays and the stones weep and the flowers open. And he finds Eurydice. Eurydice falls in love with him. And then she is stolen by Pluto, the god of the underworld. That's the gist of the basically act one in our opera. And the myth later continues where he descends into hell, saves her, and brings her back. The difference is that when Offenbach wrote this, there were already two operas about the Orpheus story. There was Orfeo by Monteverdi and Orfeo by Gluck.
Right.
And these were really considered to be the height of opera. I mean,
yeah.
You could not get any better than these pieces, particularly the Gluck. And so Offenbach just threw it on its head and said, well, he's not going to be a good lyre player. He's going to be a terrible violin player. He's not going to love his wife. He wants to divorce his wife. She doesn't get stolen by Pluto as much as she volunteers, jumps into his arms, and descends. And, I mean, that just sets up the comedy right there. Everyone
right?
goes in thinking Orpheus is going to be this great, fabulous musician. And the very first number you hear him sing is how, oh, isn't my music great? She's going, oh, it's awful, it's noise. And she's putting cotton in her ears. So that kind of sets you up for the amount of hilarity that's going to ensue.
No, it's kind of like a domestic couple instead of these, you know, lauded Greek mythology figures, right?
Very much. And Allison, our director, has moved this into the 50s, which I think is a very good choice because, A, you get away from togas and chalices of ambrosia, and, B, you get to this era where it's really believable that a husband and wife just want to end, but they can't. You know, they feel mm-hmm. restricted by societal norms. There's a wonderful character that Offenbach added to this called Public Opinion.
Oh, I love that character.
She's fantastic. Public Opinion is really the Emily Post, the Nell Nolan, the Society Page writer. You know, it's everything all together. She's constantly commenting, and she's the Greek chorus. She's commenting on everything going on whilst trying to maintain a moral aptitude amongst all the characters. And she literally drags me to hell, kicking and screaming. I don't want to go. I'm so happy that Eurydice's been stolen. And her character goes, no, 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 no. We need a second act in this opera. You need to descend into the inferno. And because also of the 50s, heaven looks like a studio backlot, which I think is genius on her part. Mm-hmm. You know, Offenbach wrote in this whole scene with the gods that they're unhappy.
Right.
You know, they're moaning, crying, they're on strike, basically. You know, they're tired of being lofty gods. They want to go down and have a bacchanal on earth and just do what they wish.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really makes sense that they're in this Hollywood backlot. There's a moon kind of dangling in the back, but not quite in the right place. The furniture's all askew. And then the second the mortal, Orpheus, comes into the picture, they clap their hands, they lift the moon, they put the furniture back because they have to put on the facade of being deities. In complete contrast to that, Hell is the greatest nightclub that ever existed. You know, there's neon lights. There's a very long bar, which is for rent at the New Orleans Scenic Studio, by the way, when this event is over, I believe.
We should just open one.
Right.
Just open a bar. We need our own bar. We need opera bar.
The opera set studio has a lot of things that could be used in a bar. When we did Vampire years ago, they had a beautiful streetcar that went across
the whole
stage.
Streetcar.
And I've often said, you know, someone should rent that, put it in their front yard and use it as a bar. But anyway.
Well, we keep trying to put it into Mardi Gras.
Right.
You know, either that or the Flying Dutchman that we had, because we have a full-scale Flying Dutchman
as
well.
Beautiful Flying Dutchman.
I love the Scenic Studio. No. It's my favorite place to go. And, of course, it's such a different vibe than the offices, you know.
Oh, very much so. I mean, there's something... particularly people who enjoy, like, the Container Store and, like, organization. Mm-hmm. When you walk into a prop studio and you go, I wonder what sort of glasses they have. And you have about 2,000 to choose from in every
right.
possible color and style and period. It's a very relaxing experience. And it's also just jaw-dropping. You walk in there and see about 50 chandeliers dangling above your head. It's very nice.
Well, one thing I think a lot of people in New Orleans, because, you know, I go around talking about the opera with strangers on every corner because that's part of my job, right? Oh, did you know there's an opera company here? Oh, you haven't been to the opera? And then, of course, I tell them all about it, right? And the Scenic Studio for me is one of those stories that I just love to tell people about because I don't think a lot of people realize that each one of our productions is built specifically for that opera. That the entire set, the cast, it's all live theater. Sometimes one of the perceptions I got on the street is that, well, you guys just bring all those people in, they're just like touring shows. I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's a very common misconception, not just in New Orleans, but sort of everywhere. But for the most part, you're right. Unless we're renting a set, which rarely happens here in New Orleans, it's being built
yeah.
right here. And that's why I love opera so much, because opera, you know, you've got great singing. If the singers weren't there, you've got a complete symphony going on. I'll never forget when I did Zalome here years ago. I went to one of the orchestra reads, and listening to Strauss's Zalome without the singing, I was like, mm-hmm. "What? This could be a piece on its own. We don't need to be here.
That's right.
You know, we're superfluous to the orchestration." And I mean, that's why opera is so wonderful, because you've got dancing in and of itself. You've got acting in and of itself. And besides all that, you've got costume design, you've got the set design, you've got light design, graphic design now with projections and things that are being put into
yeah.
operas.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of any other art form that encompasses so much.
Well, it's awesome that you say that, because one of the campaign slogans we have for this year and also our hashtag is Opera Connects. You know, because it's true. We connect the community together by building these productions.
We very much so.
We connect artist to audience, you know, by bringing the best artists that we can afford or find to bring to this opera, whether right. by hook or by crook.
You won't remember it. The apple orchard we wandered through one April afternoon. The hill behind the empty farm. A city boy, I'd never seen a grove burst in full flower or breathed the bittersweet perfume of blossoms mingled with the dust. A mile of trees and fragrant rose arching above us. We walked the aisle alone in spring's ephemeral cathedral. We had the luck, if you could call it that, of having been in love but never lovers. The bright flame burning, fed by pure desire. Nothing consumed, such secrets brought to light. There was a moment when I stood behind you, reached out to spin you toward me, but I stopped. What more could I have wanted from that day? Everything, of course. Perhaps that was the point, to learn that what we will not grasp is lost.
Casey Candabot singing The Apple Orchard, music by Laurie Lateman, text by Dana Gioia from the Hamsong Foundation, supporting the art of American song from page to stage. That's head by Thomas Hampson. Now, Casey, you're a native son. You grew up in this town.
That's right.
You know these people. You know how a town operates. And also, you grew up through the opera system here.
Yes.
From high school into college, and you went out and came back. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing. Let's start with your childhood and kind of tell me your inspiration that led you to going into opera studies and so on and so forth, and your New Orleanian experience.
Well, back when cavemen invented fire.
That happened here. Yeah. It had to happen here. I know it.
My entire family, my family has been in New Orleans on both maternal and paternal sides since Bienville got here.
Wow.
So coming up next year will be our 300th as well. although he got here a little bit before he established New Orleans. But anyway, I was really the first person in my family to have anything to do with opera.
Wow.
And I didn't know much about it. I always sang. I was 3 years old when I started singing, and I was 9 when I really started going.
Wow.
That's
pretty young.
It is. So 3 was a complete accident. It was a May crowning at my pre-K graduation. And Sister Virginia went, "Casey's loud, give him the mic." And just handed me the mic. And I sang at the top of my lungs, "Oh Mary, we crown thee with blossoms today."
Awesome.
And really never shut up since. And then when I was 9, my life really did change. A nun who has a very close history with my family. This woman taught my mother and all her sisters, was a principal at my mother's high school, and then was going to be my 5th grade teacher before she retired. So she actually never got to teach me. But she handed my 4th grade teacher a newspaper clipping that said the St. Louis Cathedral in the French Quarter is starting a boy choir. I really think Casey should go audition. And she wanted to hand it to me, but I was petrified of her. So she kept calling me over, and I would not go near her. So finally she gave it to the 4th grade teacher. He handed it to me, and I went and auditioned. And Drew Montague, who's still the head of the St. Louis Cathedral Choirs, and I think the whole music program there, as well as a teacher at Loyola University.
And a wonderful pianist.
And too. A wonderful pianist. And amazing. A good singer, too.
Yeah, he does it all.
Drew started this boy choir, and that was really what started me singing. I mean, had that moment not happened, I would not be a singer today.
Wow.
And I kept singing. I knew some about opera. My favorite story about opera is My father always listened to WWOZ's radio station, and he also liked 89.9. And 89.9 back then would have opera and then Cajun music. So he would leave it on waiting for the Cajun music to come on. And I would just sit outside listening to the opera. And once the Cajun started, go back inside. And so really that's how I started listening to opera. It was on the radio completely by accident. He wasn't paying any attention to it. And I'm just absorbing it all and listening to it. And I never really thought about opera as a career until college. I continued to sing all through high school. Choirs, and I was in several choral groups.
Did you do like Nats competitions? I mean, were you a soloist in high school?
Not really. I mean, I did solos within the chorus, and I was a cantor at a church here in town, but my teachers weren't Nats. My high school teachers had no affiliation with Nats at the time. So the idea of like even pulling the 24 Italian arias or anything like that was kind of foreign. As a boy soprano, I had done solo stuff, but
right.
Once the change happened and I became a tenor, things were different.
Yeah.
But my freshman year of college was Katrina.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was going to Loyola, New Orleans. And so we had our freshman orientation the Saturday before the storm hit.
Mm.
So, of course, I evacuated like everyone else did. And about 3 weeks later, Loyola got a hold of the locals and said, you know, what are you doing? Where will you be going to school? And I just kind of went, I have no idea.
Right.
Where should I go?
Right.
So they gave me a choice of Spring Hill in Alabama or Regis University in Denver, Colorado.
Wow.
And I wanted to go to Spring Hill because I figured that's closer. I'll go to Mobile.
Yeah.
And for some reason, namely a very pretty brunette that I met at that orientation that weekend, I ended up choosing Regis.
That's the forza del destino. Right?
I ended up going to Regis University. Actually, what really sold it was their head of the music department, a man named Mark Davenport, called me and spoke to me on the phone for about 2 hours. Mm. I remember just being in a parking lot, pacing back and forth, talking to him. And he went through everything. He said, look, we don't have a music major, but we've got a good music department. I'll get you all the one-on-one coaching you can get, and we'll just kind of give you your basics so that when you get back, you'll be ready to go.
Yep.
I said, well, really can't turn it down. So I said yes. Regis is a very small school. I think it has 2,300, at that time, probably had 2,300 kids.
Wow. It's very beautiful, too.
It's
isn't
a beautiful, it's an arboretum. So the entire, when you're within the walls of the campus, they have one of each tree that grows in Colorado, which is just stunning. And when I got there, my voice teacher was singing at Opera Colorado.
Nice.
The theory teacher. There were no rooms in the theory classes, so it was one-on-one with not one-on-one, but myself and the other Katrina refugees that were there and her. Piano was one-on-one. Languages were one-on-one. So that's really what set me up. And I still didn't think I was very good at opera, and I didn't think it was anything I could do. And then they had I can't remember the name of it, but there was like an opera guild there for Opera Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited me to start singing. And I discovered I'm a good schmoozer. I learned that at that moment, that you know, the ladies who lunch and myself, we get along really well. So
that means tenor in Italian.
Yes, exactly. That's how you say tenor, schmoozer. I like that part of the business. I like talking to people. I like learning about their lives and how they got involved with opera. And I love the singing part. And when I got back to New Orleans that December, there was a sign in the Loyola Music Lobby that said auditions for Romeo and Juliet.
Mm.
And I said, well, sure, why not? I'll audition. I did not know really any arias. I walked in and sang Comfort Ye in Every Valley from The Messiah and Già Sole del Gange from the 26 Italian Songs and Aria book. I was wearing blue jeans and a sweater, and didn't even think about putting on a suit and tie. I was like, oh, it's college. You don't have to dress up. Everyone's in ties and and I was like, uh-oh, I'm in jeans. And I got cast as Tybalt as a
wonderful
as a 17-year-old freshman, or I had just turned 18.
Wow.
And
I mean, it's a smaller part, but it's not an easy
part. It's not
an
easy part, and that taught me a lot. I mean, to go from, I'll never forget, the first rehearsal I walked in, I assumed that it was like choir. You they taught you the music while you were there.
Right, right.
So I walk in for the sing-through on day one, and I've got my score. And I've already gone through it. I've looked at it a little bit, but
right.
I was not prepared. And boy, I tell you, I have never done that again.
I know, that's a painful lesson.
I looked around and I saw everyone else singing. I immediately excused myself, ran down to a practice room and hammered out everything and went back up before Tybalt had to sing. Oh, yeah. That trial by fire there. It was like the end of Magic Flute.
That's a horrifying story. That's like a nightmare. It's like, you ever have that nightmare where you show up and you forgot the whole score?
Oh, constantly. Yeah. Or when you've done, like Orpheus. I've done Orpheus in French. I've done Orpheus in a different English translation and then this English translation. So my nightmare with that is you're going to forget and sing the wrong translation or the wrong version. Same with Elixir of Love. I've done Elixir in two English translations and Italian. And it's always like, wait, which one's going through my mind right now? It can really get to you.
Do you remember your first professional gig?
Yes. It was at New Orleans Opera. In 2006, right after I did that Tybalt, Robert Lyle hired me to sing Parpignol in Bohème, which, you know, is just those two little lines. But from that moment on, I had paid singing gigs every year.
Wow.
That was 2006. The very next year, I got hired by Opera North in New Hampshire. And they hired a 19-year-old to play Dr. Caius in Falstaff, who's the old, lecherous French doctor. So I was like, yes, okay. A 19-year-old can pull that off.
Yeah, why not?
Right on. And I mean, I've been fortunate that, you know, I kind of immediately... You know, this is my 18th show with New Orleans Opera.
That's amazing.
I counted the other day. It's 18 shows, 14 roles, and four choruses. I did four choruses, and then after the last chorus, I started with small roles, and then Robert had a role for me basically in every show. You know, and there were only 2 years that I did not have since college that I have not had a show here. And one was in grad school because I couldn't get away. And then last season, just because there wasn't anything particularly for me. Mm-hmm. And then somebody canceled and I came in and did something anyway. So,
fantastic.
Right. So, yeah.
So you've kind of been our go-to tenor in many ways.
I guess I'm your resident tenor in a way, yeah.
It sounds like it. Well, I know that Maestro Lyle likes to do that because he likes to build careers.
He does.
You know, he really cares about singers and he likes nurturing careers. So, and if he sees something in you, he will bring you back.
And Robert has been very good to me. And the roles have, you know, increasingly gotten larger or more important. I mean, this is my first... it's my second title role here with New Orleans Opera. There was a point where we were doing operas at the Maidwood Plantation in Napoleonville. Mm. We did the medium there, and then we did a very odd Gluck opera called L'Île de Merlin, Isle of Merlin, where I played Merlin. But I won't say that counts. So this is really my first title role with New Orleans Opera. And I can't talk about it, but next season I have a leading role. And so, you know.
So you'll be back.
I'll be back.
Well, that's very exciting.
I'll be back this season as well.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I'm singing in the 75th anniversary gala, which is wonderful because Robert's called some very big names in the business as well as some of the locals that have kind of, as he says, gone on to greater things. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, and you've heard that here first, everybody, because we're just now announcing that Casey Candabot is going to be singing in the 75th anniversary gala, our Diamond Jubilee celebration.
Which is April 20th and 22nd, I believe.
That's right. Our usual Friday and Sunday.
And that's at the Mahalia, right?
That'll be at the Mahalia.
Because we've done galas in all sorts of places. So this one's going to be at the Mahalia this time.
It's really a celebration of us, and we're, you know, it's part of the 300th anniversary as well. You know, opera, as we've said, and New Orleans have a long history together.
Quite.
And so we want to celebrate that. So we're hoping we're going to have local college choirs. We're going to have hopefully some international singers. We'll be announcing those as they come. And of course, if you want tickets, you can get your tickets now at NewOrleansOpera.org.
You know, another anniversary that people keep forgetting, and I could be off on a year of this, but I'm fairly certain this is Robert Lyle's 20th going into his 21st season right now.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Well, we have a few celebration points. It's also Carol Rausch's, our music administrator's, 23rd anniversary.
Really?
Yeah. And
there's another woman I wouldn't have my career without is Carol Roush.
Carol Roush. Oh, my gosh. We can never say enough about Carol Roush. If you guys don't go to Opera on Tap out there, you should, because that's Carol Roush's show.
And any chance you get to hear that woman play the piano, mm-hmm. she has this amazing ability to turn her 10 fingers into an orchestra.
Yeah.
I mean, I once did a Werther scene with her, and that is a very rich orchestration, and mm-hmm. it doesn't ever quite translate into the piano. Carol did it. Yeah. I mean, it just, yeah. it was exquisite.
She comes from that tradition of opera coach and mentor, like a Martin Katz, like a John Wussman.
That's right.
You know, she is intensifies her learning to help intensify yours.
Exactly right.
And if you ever meet Carol, you should definitely, and if you don't know Carol, you should definitely walk up to her and say hi, because you will learn something. I don't think it's possible to walk away from Carol without learning something.
And besides being a wonderful vocal coach, she's the head of opera at Loyola University now, and she's the chorus master for the New Orleans Opera. So.
That's right. That's right.
She's many hats, and music administrator, I believe.
And music administrator, library, and you name it. She does it all. And that's why we love her so. All of the opera staff, of course, is beloved. We have a lot of people who have been here a long time. One sad note that we'll be talking about a little bit, and I hope I can get him on the podcast, is our beloved box office manager of 8 years is going to be retiring in December. And so it's going to be, you know, a kind of a sad moment for us. But we're going to try and humiliate him before he goes. No one gets out of New Orleans Opera alive. No one. Now, since you're kind of now into this nice career mode, if there was advice you could give to young people who are interested in getting involved in the arts, you know, such as opera, all-encompassing, what would you tell them? Because it's not easy.
It's most certainly not easy. You know, there's the American the system, the way it works, for our audience that doesn't really know. The American way, I think more people are familiar with. You get your bachelor's, you get your master's usually. You then do training programs, summer young artist programs first, and then the year-long residencies. And then you start working. Then there's the European, or mostly the German way, where you just show up and hope with a prayer and a suitcase. And the differences are that the German system, you usually just still have your bachelor's and your master's. But you get there and you learn by having tons and tons of performances. You know, you might do 100 Goros or 150 Violettas in Traviata. Whereas the American system, you learn by classes. You learn by watching great coaches. You learn by understudying and kind of going up that way. And I don't know which one's better. I've had an odd trajectory myself in that, you know, I was 19 when I did my first young artist program, which is particularly young. I mean, the next youngest person was, I want to say, 27. So,
wow.
You know, there was a very wide range. And then I did Chautauqua Opera, which has two levels. They have the studio artists, which are usually just finishing college into their masters, and then the apprentice artists who are out there working. Then I did Marilla Opera, which is a wider range, but I rate Marilla as probably one of the top young artist programs in this country.
Oh, it's a Cadillac, yeah.
Yeah, it's the Bentley. But Marilla can range on ages. And what was odd for me was a lot of singers go through all those steps and then start performing, whereas I was performing in the middle. You know, I was doing young artist programs, and I had the wonderful roles here at New Orleans Opera and other companies that were very good to me when I was younger, and then symphonic works and all that to go. So the trajectories are always going to be different, and the greatest advice I can give is not actually mine at all. David Morlock, the great opera director who was in charge of Loyola Opera for years and was sort of the resident stage director here in New Orleans for probably 30 years.
Oh, even I knew Dave Morlock beyond New Orleans.
Did he teach at IU when you were there?
He wasn't at IU. Okay. He was at University of Illinois. I was an artist in residence there for a couple of years.
Everybody knows David Morlock. Yeah. And everything I have learned about stagecraft, I mean, it has been perfected and mastered by other teachers, but my basics all came from David Morlock. And he gave me advice as a sophomore. We were doing Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers. And he cast me as the Duke of Plaza Toro, which isn't actually technically a tenor role. It's kind of baritenor-ish.
Right.
But he said, you acted pretty well when you died in Romeo and Juliet. Let's see how you do with comedy, because that's a lot harder. And he was very kind that entire summer before we started. I met him at Still Perkin Coffee Shop, and we would go through the lines and we'd work on comedy. And I was constantly asking him questions, kind of like sucking his wisdom out of him. And at one point he said, look, the greatest advice I can give you is memorize everything you can when you're younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grab roles that you think you will do, that you want to do, and learn them young. Don't sing them, because you might really mess yourself up vocally.
Mm-hmm.
But memorize that text like a play, mm-hmm. because it is easier. I mean, everyone listening to this probably will attest, when you're younger, you can memorize things quicker.
Yep.
He also said, take every language class you can take,
yep.
which was a godsend to me. And then he said, take every repertoire class you can take. Now, when I went to Loyola, I don't know if it's changed now, they didn't have too many repertoire classes. We had a vocal literature class, and that was about it. But when I got to grad school at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, I took every repertoire class they had, to the point that the registrar actually said, you are booked for way too many units. This isn't going to work in your schedule. And I said, we will make it work.
Right.
You know, I went straight from a Britten class to a Wagner class to an Italian rep class to a postmodern Philip class. It didn't matter. I wanted to learn about every element of vocal music, because the sad thing is a lot of people go through this. They get their training. And, well, not that even that it's sad, but not everyone's going to end up being an opera singer after their training.
That's true.
You know, I mean, in my, you know, retirement plan in my head, when I can no longer sing, I actually want to take over a company. So in my head, I'm already now starting to look at the business ends. What do you need to do? Mm-hmm. Do you need to be like Max Bialystock and the producers and, you know, things
right.
like that? A little bit. But you never know when you're in college where you're going to end up. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember kids in school saying, oh, you're learning art song. Oh, opera singers never sing art song. And I'm like, have you ever bought a record?
Right. Yeah.
Have you ever listened to a CD? I mean, they all do, mostly. And I mean, same with symphonic rep. I mean, I remember singers, and of course these are people that just didn't know any better, but singers going, oh, I would never do an oratorio. And I'm like, A, they usually learn that sometimes that concert work pays more than operas, and so they quickly change their mind.
Right.
Or you can, as I do, you supplement, you do them both. I mean, I leave immediately from this to go to Los Angeles to do a Bernstein Centennial concert with the New West Symphony. Then I'm back here with the LPO doing the Messiah. I mean, you just, doing one and being good at one element of vocal music does not make you bad or less of a musician than the others.
Mm-mm.
And that would be my greatest advice to young people, is learn everything about vocal and choral music while you're young. Build a good repertoire in your head, but don't jump into singing it.
Right.
Because, you know, our vocal cords are little bitty rubber bands in our throat, and they are very sensitive, and they can easily be damaged. And, you know, you watch these kids on, like, the singing competition.
American Idol,
things like
yeah,
that.
The Voice.
And, you know, a 10-year-old girl comes out singing Nessun Dorma, and I'm just like, you're killing yourself, kid. It's the same when a 30-year-old tries to sing Nessun Dorma. You go, oh, you're killing yourself, kid.
I know. It's hard no matter right? what age you are.
So that's the thing. Learn it, and learning it and being familiar with it does not mean singing and performing it. That would, I guess, be is the simplified version of my advice.
Hey, it's all about the journey.
Sorry. That was a long journey to get to that line, but.
Come about mine ear, and sometime voices that that if I then had waked after long sleep, will make me
Casey Kandabat singing Be Not Afeard from Lee Hoiby's The Tempest, the part of Caliban, a wonderful speech when he is all alone trying to figure out why he is this malformed thing.
You learn, and particularly if you do familiarize yourself with various things, you learn what you feel, what you're good at.
Yeah.
I would have never, ever in my life thought I'd be good at modern music. I wasn't very good at theory in college. You know, I listened to a lot of the atonal, pantonal stuff in classes, and I just kind of went, eh. And my first, I guess, really modern opera was John Corigliano's The Ghost of Versailles.
Oh, I know the piece very well.
It's a stunning opera. And I got to play a villain, which doesn't usually happen.
You sang Béjart's?
I did Béjart's.
I sang Béjart's.
Really?
I
the aria of the world.
Oh, my God. It's on eternally. Oh, my God.
I did the aria of the worm for Met auditions here in New Orleans probably about a decade ago. And I have sung in the Met auditions many times since. That's the one they remember is when I sang the aria of the worm.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that was my kind of start. And that's not terribly modern. You know, Ghost of Versailles has its moments.
But yeah.
You know, that got me going, and then I've now done a lot of Jake Heggie's work. I've done a lot of Dead Man Walkings.
Mm-hmm.
I love Jake as a person and as a musician. I got to work with him last year and absolutely adore him. And then the opera that I've done more than anything else is André Previn's Streetcar Named Desire.
Awesome.
I mean, I have done that so many times now, I could actually sing the entire thing, every role for you right now. and it's a beautiful opera, and, you know, this is for all of you opera lovers listening to this. Don't be afraid of modern music. I was. You know, I knew those few examples where it sounded like a cat being thrown against a wall. And I threw all new opera into that category, and that is not the case.
That's right.
In fact, the thing I like most about modern opera is that, or contemporary opera, is that it is mainly about the text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they're setting things. Like Laurie Lateman just wrote Scarlet Letter, the opera, Jake Heggie's Moby Dick. These are great pieces of literature. They're literary masterpieces.
Like Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain. Even Dead Man Walking. You know, these are all, they were great books. Not that Romeo and Juliet wasn't, but when Gounod did Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare wasn't on this high, lofty scale. He could rip apart, add characters, change a word, do whatever he wanted.
Right, right.
Now, you know, because of the internet and because of everyone has an opinion, if you start really changing texts too much in these, you know, fantastic pieces of literature, you're going to get someone complaining about it.
Yeah.
So the new composers have to find a way to work with the language, work with as close to the actual text as possible, and still make it singable and give you great music. And that's what I really love about modern opera. Like, with you all doing the Champion That's in March, right?
Yeah, Terrence Blanchard's Champion.
I mean, that's a whole different animal in and of itself, because it is an opera in jazz, which I got to tell you, we never studied that in school. You know, opera in jazz never came up.
Yeah, I think there's like one other.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, if there was, oh yeah, exactly, Joplin's
and
opera.
That's really ragtime, so it's like birth of jazz, not what it became.
But if there was ever a city that needed to do an opera in jazz, it needed to be New Orleans. Yeah. So I'm glad we're doing that.
Well, maybe we can start a whole new Fach. You know, maybe people can start writing new original operas and jazz based on, you know, New Orleans literature.
Well, and, you know, these new pieces, just like in the old days, they're writing them for particular singers. So, you know, they look, you know, I'm doing my first, it's a brand new piece coming up in January. I consider myself very, very fortunate that the Metropolitan Opera called me and asked me to come do a brand new piece for them, and it's Matthew Oquen's Eurydice, based on the Orpheus and Eurydice myth.
You cannot escape
this
story.
I cannot escape it. What's unique about his version is it's going to be told from her perspective. You know, there are two operas and an operetta all about Orpheus, and this was finally going, no. How's Eurydice feel about this?
Right.
And they kind of have a Greek chorus character, sort of public opinion-esque, called the Stones.
Wow.
And there's Small Stone, Big Stone, and Loud Stone, and I'm Loud Stone. And so, but, you know, I've never done it. The ink is so wet on this piece that Act 3 is still being written.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And the workshop starts on December 31st. So,
So from Messiah right into this modern, amazing thing at the Met.
Exactly.
So from Roots to the Met.
Right. I mean, going from Handel to, I think Matthew Oquen is 23 years old, and he's just kind of, he's one of these people that everyone wants to work with right now. I mean, his music is edgy and beautiful. Without sounding too modern. You know what I mean? Like, because I hate using that word modern. It's like using conservative and liberal. But when you when you say modern,
it's a misnomer.
Right. Like, in my head, when I say modern, I actually always think of like Satyagraha and Akhenaten. Philip Glass is hardly modern. I mean, some of those pieces are 30, 40 years old now. So,
but when we were in college, they taught us they were modern.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, oh, even we were taught Britain was modern. And it's kind of like, oh, well.
Not so much
anymore. Not anymore, no. Minotti, modern. You know, 100 years old almost.
Yeah.
My greatest advice to opera goers is just don't be afraid of new works. You know, I remember we did Heinrich Maschner's Der Vampir here a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And I was very fortunate to have a very nice role in that. And I'll never forget being at lunch uptown. I was living in California at the time. And I'm walking out of the restaurant, and some people saw me. And they went, oh, are you in the opera? And I said, yes. We're not going. It's too modern.
Oh, my.
And Heinrich Maschner, oh, I think Der Vampir was written in 1858. You know, I just looked at him and I went, modern? This was Wagner's favorite opera. I don't know how you mean modern.
Right.
But, you know, people do, they get afraid. They get in their boxes, and even with, I mean, some people might be afraid of this, might be afraid of an operetta, because it's...
I think people are always afraid of opera a little bit,
even
us diehard, you know, goers, because I think what happens is, you know, either it's your anticipation of what you want it to be, or your expectation, I should say, and the anticipation, you know, or you're afraid you won't know what's going on, you know, but that's why we go to the theater, though.
Exactly.
Is to not know what's going on. You can go to Netflix, you can watch TV, you can walk down the street and you know exactly what you're going to get, but the whole idea of live theater is that you won't know what's going to happen from moment to moment for at least a two-hour, three-hour block, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that,
There's not, you know, and I don't think she'll hate me for sharing this story with you. Dottie Randall, who is our coach for this production. I love Dottie. I've worked with Dottie at Chautauqua and here in New Orleans several times.
She's quite brilliant.
And Dottie always says, she's from San Antonio, so I'll try to do her accent, I only play music from Rossini to Puccini. Everything else is pre- and post-music. And I've always loved that quote. And then she was telling me just yesterday about seeing Hydrogen Jukebox this summer. She said, I avoided all the rehearsals. I knew I wasn't going to like it. She said, I finally went and I sat there. And by the end, I was bawling.
Yeah.
It was such a moving piece of theater and it was such good music that she was crying. And I said, now, don't you feel? She went, well, it still might be post-music, but I loved it. You know. But, I mean, that's... you all did Laura Kaminsky's As One this
summer.
That's
right. That's right. We did it at the end of May, beginning of June.
Right. I didn't know if that was considered part of this season or last season. I don't know how.
It was a little
interseason.
In
yeah.
Yeah, interseason, yeah.
And I went to that, and I had never seen that piece. I had never heard it. I knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went in knowing the story, knowing what was going to go on. When I tell you there were people behind me actually crying, I mean, full on, almost, I thought they were having a panic attack.
Yeah.
Tears going on behind me. And during the intermission, I asked them, or during at the end of the opera, I asked them, have you been to an opera before? And they said, no, are they all like this? Mm. And I said, they should all tug on your strings a little.
Yep.
Even the comedies.
Yep.
You know, you should be able, if we do our jobs right as singing actors, there should be something in that piece which tugs at you.
Yeah.
You know, I love it when they cry. You know, I do.
I do too.
I adore when they cry. There's only been one time that I started crying, and I felt like such a schlub. But I was singing Peter's aria from Die Totenstadt, the very last one, when the opera ends, and he just kind of realizes, well, we all die.
Right. Korngold's catharsis.
I love Korngold. But
yeah.
I did that for a competition, and I learned a trick when I was young that when you end an aria, you kind of picture someone you love or you want to love or can't love slowly disappearing. Mm-hmm. And that gives your eyes this little bit of extra life
at the
end of an aria. And so I did that. And as I pictured that, I just started crying.
Yeah.
And the judges went, was that shtick? And I went, oh, no, it just really happened.
No.
Wasn't supposed to. But sometimes if we do it right, we even tug at our own heartstrings. You know, we're human, too.
That's right. Well, that's the best, actually, you know, because when you resonate the feeling as genuinely as you can, the audience
feels
it.
The audience can tell when you're being fake, you know.
They sure can. They know right away. I mean, you can't. That's the funny thing. One last indulgence in that. And that's a funny thing about people in music is like we all pretend like we have secrets, right? And that's one of the things why we like drama so much is because you're watching people pretending as they have secrets. But what the audience knows and what we all truly know in our hearts is there are no secrets among humans.
Oh, no.
You know?
And that's what makes, I think, all actors, but particularly opera singers, you have to sort of lower yourself. And I don't mean demean, but you have to reduce all these layers in order to get to this level where you can expose yourself to an audience.
Right, let the safety stand.
Right. If you don't, then there will always be a wall up.
Yeah.
And it's tricky. I'm not a method actor by any stretch of the imagination. You know, in Dead Man Walking, it's a powerful opera. And I know a lot of singers that at the end of that execution can't even socialize. They're so shaken. I'm not that kind of performer. You know, I'm like that in the moment. And the second they say, okay, rehearsal's over, I'm like, where's the bourbon?
I know, right?
But within that moment, I definitely feel myself, you know, just sort of pulling a Shrek and losing onion, layers of onion, which is why a lot of people say it's impossible to date opera singers because, you know, either we're always performing or we're just so exposed, vulnerable, and emotional that we're a wreck. So that might be. But that's why I love opera. I mean, love the music, but I love that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And to me, no show has done it more. The New Orleans Opera's production of Manon Lescaut years ago.
Mm.
It was one of the last ones we did at Tulane McAllister in the post-Katrina era. And no one had done it before. I'm fairly certain Robert hadn't conducted it before. The director had none of the singers. And I had a small role in it. And so when no one's done it before, that can sometimes really go awry.
Mm-hmm.
But Puccini wrote such beautiful music, and it was such a good story that instead we just all went with it.
Mm.
And that, to date, was one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had because everyone experienced every emotion in that piece.
Yeah.
I was the dancing master. I was there for comic effect.
Right, right.
And still, I felt everything that Manon did, you know, wrenching my heart. So
this poor,
poor girl. That's why we do this.
That is why. You know? Beautiful. Well, Casey, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come speak with me and speak to our audience about this opera and about your wonderful career. We're all following you and very excited to see what comes in your future, even next week at Orpheus in the Underworld on November 10th and 12th. We want you to come out. And, of course, come to the rest of the operas. We're doing 7 operas, more venues, different places. Tabasco will be at Le Petit Theater in the Quarter. And then we've got The Medium, which will be at the Jazz Marketplace. So we've got lots of different variety this year. And, of course, Terrence Blanchard's Champion coming up in March. We're very excited about that. This will be a historic opera for many, many reasons. So be sure to get your tickets now at NewOrleansOpera.org. Or you can call at 504-529-3000. And remember, opera connects, and we connect to you. Now, every week on here, New Orleans Opera at Large, with your host, Joe McKesson, a.k.a. Opera Joe, the marketing director of New Orleans Opera. Thank you. See you next week.
Thanks, Joe.